Hello. Welcome to recording number 6 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. The archives of recordings 1 through 5 are now available on the Cannon Fire website. All right. Now, we're going to begin tonight with Chapter 5, which has already started. It is page 47, paragraph 2. San was one of the few of his fellow beggar thieves whom Gord associated with and liked. The boy was clever and looked upon him as a mentor, especially since Gord had attained the status of least master. Break. A little background. Last night we found San was introduced. He is about 10 years old. Gord, at this point, is probably about 12 or 13. Still very small. San was mentioned that even though he is only around 10, is bigger than Gord is right now, or nearly as large as Gord. Here we have the mention of the beggar thieves and Gord's status as least master, which was covered in the last recording. All right, I'm going to restart here. This is page 47, paragraph 3. What are we going to do, Gord? Easy, San. We just cruise the strip and look for likely prospects. The beggar master wants hostages to trade for his fat hide safety. We'll line them up, and the muscle will knock them over. Gord said casually, even though he was filled with terrible tension at the assignment. After all, he was small and no match for an experienced thief. What if he somehow bungled the mission? Swell, San said with a grin. Just show me what to do, and it'll be easy. You're the best, Gord. Now Gord was even more nervous, for he had hoped that his comrade would have some idea of how to actually set up some tough and accomplished thief for capture. Obviously, his rank placed the burden solely upon his small shoulders. Break. All right, well, here we have in these paragraphs, this is a part of what's been going on, that Gord and another one of the beggar thieves is out with some of the mercenaries that have been hired. The mercenaries, men-at-arms, clerics, and even a few magic users and assassins have all been hired. And the beggar master is looking to capture thieves even more than killing them off. And here we have Gord. We show again that San, how much he looks up to Gord. And Gord, although he's been showing signs that he is a much changed person in the last few months, with a sense of authority and trying to take after the other beggar thieves that are in authority, like Fergo, he still is still has the essence of that. Thinks of himself as that inexperienced young orphan is still there, where he's looking to the younger 10-year-old Sam to think up ideas on how to set up and capture the thieves. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 47, and we are on paragraph 7. San was looking at him expectantly, so Gord shrugged and replied, "Right, just watch me, kid, and follow my lead." Getting to their destination had been easy, if somewhat smelly. After passing down through the deep cellar, Gord, San, and three mercenaries garbed in plain cloaks went through the sewers for nearly a mile. Their way was illuminated by a lantern that glowed with an oddly bright and steady light, which Gord concluded must have been cleric-cast light. The use of flame down here would be dangerous. For sewer gas was explosive as well as poisonous, but they had been told that this section was quite safe, and it did seem relatively unused, all in all. Break. All right, well, here we see Gord's group. Gordon, San, two very young beggar thieves. But in general, the beggar thief cadre from the beggar master seems to be boys and girls, all fairly young, and if not very young, children or early teenagers. We have an example here of a little magic. There's an illuminated lantern glowing with an odd, steady light and a clerical light. So something that in this, a cleric is casting some kind of light upon a lantern that is making it shine. And I can't think of the first edition spell offhand that would be. They're down in the sewers, which are underneath the beggar master's mansion. And as it's stated, that normally the sewer gas is known as an explosive and poisonous substance down in those sewers. But somehow this area has been cleared of all that. But still, they don't want to have open flame down in this section. So here's some idea if you're running a Beggar Master campaign or a Beggar's Thieves Guild War campaign. Here's something about that mansion. That underneath the cellar is the sub-level, an entrance to the sewers that allows access anywhere within the city of Greyhawk.
I think the spell would be Continual Light.
All right. That's I don't know why, but that just doesn't... That's the 1E clerical spell? What level was that?
I'm not sure if it's 1E. It might be 2nd edition.
All right.
I googled it and it comes up as a level 3 second edition clerical spell. I'm not sure if it's in 1E. I could dig out my book in a second.
Yeah, it's just offhand. It just doesn't strike me as a 1E clerical spell, the continual light or light, as much as it is a very basic magic user spell.
I mean, he could be wrong in that it was clerical, too, right? I mean, but...
Well, I mean, we're getting this from Gord's perspective.
Right.
So it is not necessarily that what we're hearing is even going to prove true within the story.
Right.
It wouldn't be inconsistent for Gord to say something and be completely wrong.
Right.
I mean, Gord has been learning since he came, but it's only been a few months. And Gord should not be that knowledgeable of many things as a poor orphan struggling on a day-to-day survival in the slum quarter. He should not be beyond what is the most common knowledge of a lowly citizen of Greyhawk, and probably the lowliest of citizens of Greyhawk, of the city of Greyhawk.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't see it as a clerical spell in 1E. I saw it as illusionist and... Oh, wait, no, there it is. It is third level cleric spell, continual light.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, that seems like it would be a pretty powerful item then for them to have as a third level clerical spell over a first level magic user spell. You know, a light spell cast on the lantern. But again, Gord, it even says Gord's concluding it that it must be cleric cast light. He may have more experience of clerics than he does of magic users at this point.
Yeah, but he's fairly good.
It could be exactly what they said, clerical continual light. All right, I am going to continue. It is page 47, last paragraph. When they reached the place marked with the symbol, meaning good action, in the beggar's sign, they clambered up a long ladder of rusty iron after hooding the lantern and leaving it to swing on a lower rung. One of the burly mercenaries had to lift the heavy gate barring the sewer's alley drain. Again, all five emerged. The drain was closed with its grate again, and the two boys led the expedition through the dark streets of the quiet trade district towards Grand Square. The sword wielders were well to the rear, and it was not obvious that the two groups had any connection. Break. Well, I break here. One point, again, now this had been mentioned earlier, but again, there is a beggar sign, and this is something specifically named. It is called the beggar sign, and so there are a written series of symbols that are part not only of a beggar's verbal language or hand signals, but there are also written signals, the beggar sign here, for the other beggars to recognize, and a secret language that only they would know. That's something that's, you know, in earthly parents, there's the hobos and the homeless, or the people living rough in England. They supposedly had these marks that they would put down in front of houses to say if the person was an easy touch, or whether the person would just throw them out or dump water on them. And
even in the early 2000s, there were a bunch of people in the U.S. who would do something called war driving, where you would get chalk and you would draw it out in front of a building and mark it, like with the kind of wireless access point that was available.
All right. And
yeah, so you know, still going on.
And there had been gang signs, hand right. gestures. Well, of course, you know, anything useful is usually continued. We have that the sword wielders, obviously these are NPC fighters who are going around with them. And we're told that the trade district and the Grand Square. Now, the trade district that is mentioned here, I don't think that's more of a general term than the actual name of a district. And I had thought they were headed toward the Strip and the River Quarter, and I can't remember where the Grand Square is supposed to be located. But all of this is quite a distance. Traveling through the sewers, it's quite a distance from where they would have started all the way up in Old City to get all the way down here, because that would have been, even if a straight travel would have been a few miles distance between one and the other, because Gygax's City of Greyhawk is a much, much larger city than is shown in the City of Greyhawk box set.
Yeah, it said they went about a mile underground, right?
Did it say? I must have.
I think it said they weaved around for about a mile underground. At least wow. That was in my head. And then they came up at the Waghalter Gate, I think, which looks like.
You're jumping ahead a little bit.
Oh, here. Am I? I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what we're just going to come to right here.
Oh, okay. Because I got the map in front of me. I printed it out. I'm using the City of Hawks map.
All right. Okay. Here we go. So I'm going to restart on here. So this is going to be restart page 48, paragraph 2. Gord and Sam talked to each other, acted frolicsome, and laughed as normal boys out for fun would do. They walked the long way from near Waghalter Gate, the place in the wall of Old City where they entered the Thieves' Quarter, past the Grand Square and Citadel, and through the halls in Clerkburg rapidly. Their skill at seeming playfulness and dalliance while they were actually moving quickly toward their destination would have impressed the Grand Master of Thieves. Pushing, shoving, and laughing led to one chasing the other, and then the roles were reversed. This was easy. Break. All right, well, here we have the Waghalter Gate.
Okay.
Waghalter, the wall of the old city, that is to the entrance of the thieves' quarters. And then, yeah, the Grand Cis Square and Citadel, the Halls, and even Clarkburg, they're more towards Central Greyhawk. And, yeah, I would say, you know, that, okay, it seems like from what their travel underground was more toward getting from the edge of the Thieves' Quarter to the other edge of the Thieves' Quarter. So that may have been about a mile by the map that is in City of Hawks. And then we have several mentions. You know, like I just said, we have Dyckhalter Gate, we have the Grand Square, the Citadels, the Halls, the Clarkburg, and no real definition of what they are just yet, but just little names that are dropped. And they are, you know, quarters and sections of the City of Greyhawk. Now, the other part here is that we do see, I'm not sure it's used as a, that the Grandmaster of Thieves would have been impressed, whether that is just a bit of a grandiose statement there, or whether the two young beggar thieves are of such skill that they really would have impressed the Grandmaster of Thieves. It does seem that both San and Gord are very well trained, but they should still not be much more than zero or first level within the amount of training and experience they would have gotten. I don't believe. So I'm going to restart here.
Oh, as far as the trade areas go, there's quite a few trade areas that seem to separate the new city from the old city. So they're all along the wall for old city. And I think they're on, I don't know where the processional comes in, but they're close to the wall. The
processional divides Gygax's city, like straight up and down, north and south, from top to bottom.
All right, so they're inside the processional then, closer to the wall.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it goes all the way down to the southern gate.
It goes from the slums, beggars' quarter, thieves' quarter, foreign quarter. So all not all the way down to the southern gate. It's at the halls and the craftsman's ward. That's where it stopped.
And the processional it's outside of Old City.
Mm-hmm.
The Old City walls, and as later described by Gygax, unlike most depictions and most depictions of these cities, the City of Greyhawk is kind of like Rome. It's built on a series of hills. Mm-hmm. So within the city walls themselves, there are rises and falls, and Old City is kind of on a plateau, you know, up in the eastern section, and it's got its own wall around it. And below that is the processional. And the processional is the main thoroughfare, the main street, the largest of any of the streets or pathways or roads within Greyhawk. And it does kind of just go from north, from south to north. You know, and
yeah, it looks like it connects Southgate to Lord's Gate.
Yeah, it's so it is, but it's right in the middle of the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing that interrupts it is the Plaza de Hot or something.
Yeah, which
that's like right in the center.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a market plaza. I'm pretty sure that is more of an assembly area.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps for speeches or, you know, gatherings where they people would want to know what's going on or announcements. I don't think it is a particularly trade area, that plaza.
It's a shame, but I don't know how people would understand what's going on if they use the box set.
The box set
would make sense.
Oh, it would be so confusing.
Yeah.
It would be so confusing.
Sorry, I didn't want to derail with the map conversation, but...
Oh, this definitely should have had the City of Hawks map in this book. And if you have the City of Hawks, while you're reading Sog of Old City, you can see where what is being talked about here matches that map.
Right, it actually works.
It does. And it is not, and then also, especially Knight Errant, has especially one short story called Twistbuck's Game, mm-hmm. which names more streets and inns than any other story or book in the Gygax lore. It's in the story Knight Errant. And without the map that you get in City of Hawks, it's tremendously nebulous. It's very, very confusing. But it's kind of meant to be that way. You're meant to just do this kind of theater of the mind where mm-hmm. Gygax is telling you what's going on in this book, short story. And in that story, though, there's so many named streets, so many named inns. It's really rich with that name dropping that you can later use inspiration for. And if you have the City of Hawks map, it makes sense. He really was looking at that map, and that was what was happening here. So I kind of think that map must predate the stories themselves, because that's what's here and what's in the other books matches the City of Hawks, City of Greyhawk map.
Yeah, using the City of Hawks map, they're going north to south. But if you were to use the box set map, it would seem they were going south to north. So it's completely different direction. It depended on which map you use.
Yeah, and the City of Greyhawk box set is just not, it in many, many ways, is not Gygax's City of Greyhawk.
There you go.
And it makes it very difficult when you are looking at, like, say, this book, and then you see that the box set, and then you realize, now I can understand, because as we've read through here, the tone of these Saga of Old City is much darker. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a much grimmer, darker, even a vile place for the most part when we go through Old Town. It is not the areas they're through. And for any city to have such a really vile place within its walls and the attitude of people within power that they really don't care, it really is striking, because there should be, there should be clerics and good deities, and there should be a push toward helping the lowliest of the citizens. Mm-hmm. There isn't. Now, the only other thing that I wanted to mention is that throughout this story, the dialogue is to me a little out of place. Even the most idle comments that are made here and there, he uses various things that are the idioms of more like the early 1920s and 30s in the United States than you'd expect to see in a fantasy world or a fantasy medieval world. So I find the dialogue to be a little jarring, to not quite fit what would say like the fantasy, Lieber's Lochmar, which is kind of an inspiration for Gygax's City of Greyhawk, is Lieber put more thought into how they would talk to fit that fantasy city. And here the dialogue just seems early 20th century, sometimes things like that work and sometimes they don't. I'm reminded of the TV series Rome, where all the Romans spoke British English,
right?
You know, and not only that, but they had the accents. For the people who are upper class and lower class, match those of England.
I don't know if I noticed that, but
it fit, and I think it worked very well in the movie, the TV show or the cable show. But they did not try to Latinize. They instead. With that, they tried to make it consistent, but at the same time, it was a little humorous when you realize that like the lower class might even speak with a lower class British accent. Mm-hmm. So it was very interesting what they had done, and I don't quite find the same thing in the Gord novels, where just within the last few pages. Some of the commentary and the dialogue just seems to be more early 20th century than fitting more in fantasy medieval.
I think maybe he purposely tried to avoid fantasy tropes.
And he might well have, because it seems to be, at least at this point, pretty much consistent throughout this book that he's using that. I find it a little jarring rather than, I find those early 20th century kind of idiom that not to fit in well for what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. So it all depends on how you feel about those things. And it may be right that Gygax had made a conscious decision that he wasn't going to try some tis and thou and that's fine, but instead try to do something that he felt would be more understandable, and that this was going to be a real world, and try to make it as real and connective, a connection with that dialogue to the readers, which would have been the readers in the 1980s. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 48, and it is paragraph 3. Once opposite the entrance to the strip, the pair crossed the processional and were soon deep among the roiling celebrants of the place. The Thieves' Guild represented more than robbers, burglars, cutpurses, and the ilk. The organization also controlled gambling, prostitution, swindles, extortion, loan sharking, fencing of loot, smuggling, forgery, and counterfeiting, to list the more obvious. Most of these activities were going on here, visibly or invisibly. Break. Well, I'm break here because there is the mention of the strip, the processional. We've had those before. But here we have a more detailed description of what the City of Greyhawk Thieves Guild is like. Now, we already know that Aaron Thall, who's the head of the Thieves Guild, he is one of the directors, one of the people running the city. And so the Thieves Guild itself is one of the other directors, is head of the Merchants Guild. So the Thieves Guild is an accepted part of the City of Greyhawk community. It is not an underground, kind of a mobster. It is accepted. But we hear here all the various things that the Thieves Guild is doing, not just outright visible robbery, burglary, but they're also doing a lot of the things that organized crime might do. And again, that brings the city. Now, the City of Greyhawk has always tended to more of the neutral. The descriptions so far kind of lended toward neutral evil, but maybe lawful evil. But it does not seem to be a good city. I would say at most, everything they're describing here, and for the Thieves Guild to exist out in the open, doing all these various criminal activity, that just speaks of a city that is a little, even if that is not permitted on the face, even if not this is illegal, But if the Thieves Guild has different dispensations for, like, if you're, I don't know how they've broken it up. If a Thieves Guild thief is caught doing it, are they just given up to the authorities, or they did, would they receive a lesser punishment than a non-Thieves Guild thief? So far, it's not mentioned. But
yeah, and what would stop the Thieves Guild from taking everything?
Yeah, I mean, there has to be some kind of social contract,
right,
between how the Thieves Guild does their criminal activities, even if and if they are criminal, because it would seem that these are crimes that they're describing. But, well, I mean, it would say, is gambling a crime? You know, I mean, it may not be at all. I mean, Greyhawk prostitution probably isn't a crime when a courtesan, like Violet was pretending to be,
right,
was accepted as a lady of high society because of the influence she might have. But things like counterfeiting and forgery and smuggling, fencing of loot, well, if they extortion, who are they extorting but other free citizens? And who are they stealing from but people of some wealth within the city? There has to be some kind of balance between the non-thieves and the thieves. And, you know, in various books that I've read, say Terry Pratchett, is Ankh-Morpork, the Thieves Guild was accepted, and what you would do is you would pay them off so that they could only steal a certain amount from you, you know. But on the other hand, they also would not be brought up for, if they were caught, they would not be receive any great or any punishment at all, because they were licensed thieves. So it doesn't have to be that straightforward here, and it doesn't have to be locked down to where there's a written rule. There could be all these laws on the book, and then most of them are ignored by an unwritten rule. You know, that's the way a lot of societies operate, is that the unwritten rule is what's followed, but the written rule is out there because that is what affects the people who don't have the power, who aren't members of the guild, who aren't really wealthy, who are lower class workers or merchants or craftsmen, and that the aristocracy and the upper members of these things and the members of the guilds get the benefits, while the other members of society are more preyed upon, and by both sides, where they are have crimes committed against them, but if they commit a crime, they receive a worse punishment. But it does go to speak right here just what kind of city the Gygax's city of Greyhawk actually is. Now, as I remember from the box set, they do have their Thieves Guild. They do have their Thief Master, who is part of the directing oligarchy. I think he may even be Lord Mayor at one point, or one of them, you know. So, again, it's trying to encompass a little bit of what Gygax is doing, but Gygax does things in this story in a much darker way. I think trying to be a little more adult, but really there's a much darker feel to this City of Greyhawk than to the City of Greyhawk box set.
I don't think we've had any light, right? It's all been dark.
Yeah. This has been unrelenting. I mean, it's just been, but we have been only seeing really Gord going through the worst of the worst.
Right. We've seen slums, the jails, and the beggar's quarter.
And a little touch of the garden quarter, but really maybe a more decadent, reprehensible section of it.
Right.
It doesn't mean that there really would be anything from our viewpoint that would make the City of Greyhawk described here anything but a little dark and grim to very dark and grim. Alright, I'm going to restart right here. We're on page 48, and this is the last paragraph. Against such power, the beggars had few and weak means. Allied with the beggars were the lowly street gangs, quacks, gypsies, tinklers, peddlers, jongleurs, and actors. But none such were in view as the two lads strolled westward along the Street of Delights. There were more than the usual number of ruffians, not the street variety, but out-of-work laborers. Their presence in such large numbers indicated to Gord that they had been paid to roam the area in search of enemies of the Thieves Guild. The dull eyes of these toughs passed over both boys without really seeing them. Although it was not really worth the trouble, Gord actually went out of his way to steal the purse of one of these ruffians. They did need a few coins to spend anyway, or they would arouse suspicion when they began a serious search for a target. Break. All right, well, here we've got the Street of Delights named, and the area of the city that they're in with the strip is a very more rough and tumble place, as described by the various activities of the streets and the crowded thieves, the thieves' activities. And now we have that the thieves have ruffians. Rather than the mercenaries hired by the beggar thieves, they have these ruffians, which would be like unleveled commoners or zero-level commoners, of a little bigger and burly sort. Now, we're also given here, as we were in the last paragraph, we're told what kind of activities the Thieves Guild were, but we're also now shown in this one what kind of allies the Beggars Guild has, the Beggars Union. And it is pretty much the dregs of Greyhawk society, where tinkers, peddlers, jongleurs, quacks, which would be, street doctors rather than more accepted professionals, I would say, or street healers, very low healers, gypsies. Gypsies, I'm not sure whether they would be Rene, barge folk, or Atloy, the wandering Rene, or if gypsies is a description of a kind of profession rather than any kind of society or culture. Lowly street gangs, first per se, like the headsmen were, and actors. I find that amusing. But that was always the medieval, that actors were thought of very low class.
Yeah, I thought tinkers were gypsies.
I always thought tinkers were the ones who did the, the spot metal work, than
fix cups and
a lot of work with copper and brass and tin. I'm not sure. I would assume peddlers are the very lowest of the merchants. People whose whole merchandise is carried on them on their back, or on a horse or donkey or in a cart. It all speaks of a very, very low class, which is suitable for who the beggars would be allied with. But it doesn't really speak up to being a particularly, viable army there of allies. It seems like they would be fairly weak group in a confrontation.
Right.
At least Theobald the Beggar Master has thought to actually hire classed and leveled mercenaries. Because even, swordsmen, men-at-arms, those are definitely talking about trained fighters of some sort. And then anyone who would be a cleric, assassin, or magic user would have to be a skilled, of some skill. Even if it's just first level, they're definitely more skilled than a commoner. And, you know, I mean, quite effective if you say, like, you had a magic user, even if they could only cast sleep, how many commoners they could bring down in a group, by casting sleep. And different advantages to having a cleric or an assassin, and how much better a trained fighter is over a commoner, knowing how to use the various armor and weapons without penalty. Even if they're not receiving a huge, at first level or so, not a huge bonus over a commoner in their combat ability, is and their ability to wear professional armor well, to do justice to it, to know how to use a sword, to know how to use a polearm or a bow or a crossbow or a sword and shield, or that is a big advantage over your average laborer. That's just a big rough laborer. So I'm going to restart right here, and it is page 49, and it is the second paragraph. A crowded gambling house called the Wheel of Gold drew Gord's attention. He and San went in casually, and both moved here and there. As a bouncer began eyeing them, Gord produced 4 bits and tossed the brass coins on a table where wagers were being made on which color hole a rat would appear from. His bet was on white. Nobody else seemed to have any faith in that color, for their bets were stacked in piles of bronze and copper, even a few silver nobles, on the 8 other colors. San looked worried, but Gord smiled. Sure enough, the trained rodent eventually came through the hole before the white space. They now had 8 brass bits, and Gord took them and left for another game. "You sure are lucky," San remarked to his companion. Gord was surprised at this. "Lucky? You're kidding. White was the color that had to win." Now it was San's turn to be surprised. Don't try to tell me you can read rats' minds, Gord. Shit, no, Gord explained. Just use your head, dummy. Every other color had a stack of heavy coin on it, and I got my bits down just before the wheel was spun, so the rat had to come out on white. But I don't follow you, Sam said abashed. The game's rigged, of course, Gord explained with the patient voice of a teacher talking to an eager but somewhat slow pupil. The shills win big, the suckers small, and the rat always comes up on the color the operator selects. There was big sucker money with all of the shills' coins, so when she scanned the table, the operator went for a big hit, cleaned out the chumps, and we doubled our cash. Why'd she let us win instead of someone else? 4 brass bits, you must be jesting. Let's find our target and quit fooling around. Break. All right. Well, here we have the Wheel of Gold, a gambling house. Now, I believe this is the first gambling house that is described. And so it's different from an inn or from, a tavern. This is, is specifically a place where there's going to be, the main thing is going to be the gambling. And we're shown basically a very rudimentary con that is, being done, and that Gord is aware of, and yet San, who's a little younger, still hasn't caught on to or had explained. And something that seems very obvious that, Gord, with his 4 bits, his bits is going to win, whereas the places that would have paid out silver nobles isn't going to. Now, one of the things that this does is, I've talked about before, is the denominations. Mm-hmm. And we have iron drabs as the lowest. They aren't even mentioned here. But then we had we have the brass bits, the bronzes, the copper commons, and the silver nobles. Now, here we have it kind of broken down for us. Iron drabs aren't mentioned. Brass bits are, as the lowest, of the 4 that are mentioned here, it's the lowest value. so we can rank them there. We don't have a breakdown between the brass bits and the how many brass goes to a bronze, how many bronze to a copper, how many a copper to a silver. But what we can say is it goes iron, brass, bronze to copper to silver. Now, if there's something between copper and silver, it hasn't been mentioned, but we have 5 denominations of coins already. So this is, you know, this is quite a variety considering there can even be breakdowns in size of coins within, but we definitely have named coins, 5 different named coins that are mentioned so far in the book. And we do have a good idea of now that they go from iron, brass, bronze, copper, silver. We don't really have much more. I mean, I can get a picture in my head of what this could be like. The game itself sounds, a little strange. The rat in a hole kind of, I'm surprised they don't aren't hitting it on the head or anything. But, whack-a-mole, whack-a-rat, yeah. But, you know, I mean, basically it's a carnival kind of game. That perhaps everybody in USA society has seen at carnivals or at beaches, the place itself, I think we can get an idea that it is something between kind of a more like a Western gambling house kind of idea that we'd see in the 19th century American West. In a sense, more than the kind of, say, this seems like a little out of place for a medieval, but this is fantasy medieval. And so we have a good description here of the idea of what the Wheel of Gold is like in the city of Greyhawk.
Do we know where it is?
Yes, we know it's on the Strip.
Okay. On the Street at the Lights or something?
I'm sorry?
Is it the Street of the Lights?
Street of the Lights. It mentions Street of the Lights. Yeah. And I'm not sure if it's supposed to be on the Strip. Nothing else has been mentioned.
I see.
They're westward along the Street of the Lights in the previous paragraph. And I would say that it just implies... It could be, we could be told, oh, well, they didn't say it, but the Wheel of Gold is really not on the Strip or whatever. But the last things mentioned were the Strip and the Wheel and the Street of the Lights. So I'm just assuming that the Wheel of Gold is right there on the Street of the Lights, and the Street of the Lights is on the Strip. And I went through all this because there really wasn't much more within all this, except, again, we see that Sam... Gord is the voice of the teacher, and Sam is the pupil. And even though Gord is not, he is a least master at the, and there is a breakdown of that of 3 kinds of, between least master, and I forget offhand what the next level was, and then there's a full master who's the head of, who is that, but they're all masters. So
is it journeyman or something?
I don't know if it was journeyman. I think it was a different word. It's
associate.
I believe it's mentioned in, maybe associate, and it's mentioned in, I think, recording 4 or 5.
Yeah, right after he was just promoted, they talked about it.
Right after they went out and had the problem with Violet, mm-hmm. and before he discovers that she's been murdered. All right, we're actually getting this hour's going pretty quick.
Yeah.
And so I am going to restart here. It is page 49, and it is the last paragraph. As the boys slowly wagered and their coin supply dwindled, the 3 mercenaries moved into position nearby. Gord inclined his head only slightly, and the trio directed their attention to a table where dicing was bringing shouts and cheers. There were over 12 players, mostly men. With another nod and a finger signal, Ward pointed to a fellow dressed in dark blue velvet who seemed more interested in watching than in playing. He had his eye on a drunken riverboat captain who had been lucky indeed this evening. His purse bulged with winnings. The fellow had a pair of sailors with him, but these two were nearly as drunk as their captain, and both had some measure of good fortune, too. Likely prospects, indeed. Ward and San wandered over to the dicing table and began carefully looking for the associates of the thief in blue, while pretending to be interested in the play and occasionally wagering. When the four others in the thieving group were located, Ward passed the new information to his cohorts in the same manner as he conveyed the earlier intelligence. The stage was set. Break. All right, well, we've got another description of the Wheel of Gold. They have their dice tables. Then we also see how the Thieves Guild is set up to rob this riverboat captain. Now, one of the things, very similar in its sense to how Gord is setting up the thieves to be attacked by the beggar thieves and the mercenaries. Now, we also see mention here that this is a riverboat captain. That could be anything from somebody who is operating a boat that is more than likely just moving supplies and goods up and down the Velverdiva, you know, which is the river or the Selatan. And it's definitely not a captain who is, you know, going out and hugging the coast, and definitely more of moving goods and perhaps people back and forth along the great rivers here around the city of Greyhawk. All right, I'm going to restart. We're on page 50, paragraph 3. The riverman wasn't stupid, even if he was well in his cups. When his luck had turned and the heap of coins before him had been reduced to half its former size, he decided to leave. After tipping the operator of the game, the proprietor of the house, and the serving girl who kept his jack filled with ale, all in lavish manner, the captain departed with his two crewmen in tow. All seemed less tipsy than they had while playing, but they were certainly inebriated and less alert than they should have been. Four of the thieves had left several minutes ahead of the rivermen and taken up casual positions across the street from the Wheel of Gold. The three mercenaries had strolled out the door shortly thereafter and taking up an inconspicuous position a short distance down the street. Not far behind them were Gord and Sam, who came out the door and leaned against the outer wall of the Wheel of Gold, pretending to be occupied with counting their meager holdings, while Gord actually kept a close eye on the proceedings. When the sailors exited the gambling house, they were promptly followed by the head thief in blue, not trying very hard to hide his presence any longer. Ward had an excellent vantage point, much nearer to the rivermen than the four thieves or his and San's three cohorts. He noticed one of the sailors nudge his captain and cast his eyes briefly back over his shoulder, and the riverman responded with a small wink as he turned and headed across the street toward a narrow passage between two buildings. "Let's stop down this way for a minute, mates," the captain said, loud enough for all around to hear. "I needs to let out some of that ale I've been putting in." He and his guards continued into the dark corridor, undoubtedly readying themselves to surprise whoever might follow them in. The fellow in blue continued to walk slowly after them, and paused against the wall just outside the passageway, while the sailors moved on. The four thieves across the street, meanwhile, had disappeared inside the building adjoining the dark passage. A quick glance down the street told Gord that the mercenaries were likewise nowhere to be seen at the moment, but he trusted that they were on the job. Counting slowly to himself, Gord estimated the time it would take the quartet of thieves to get through the building and out into the other end of the passage. His estimate was good, for at about the time he thought the four would be ready, the blue-garbed thief came to life. He drew a short sword from under his cape and entered the narrow space between buildings, going into a defensive crouch as he did so. The sound of steel on steel rang out. The rivermen probably carried long dirks, thought Gord, and even in their drunken state might be able to hold off a single swordsman. Then, suddenly, there were cries of pain and surprise. The four thieves had struck from behind, and the sailors were in serious trouble. Unless one was aware of what was happening and listening carefully, none of the combat sounds would have meant anything, for the shouts, laughter, shrieks, and music of the adjacent establishments, combined with the noises of passers-by, to make a confused din. All was quiet in the dark passage for a minute, and then more cries and combat noise came from the corridor. The beggars' mercenaries were giving the thieves a goodly dose of their own medicine. It was time for the boys to move in. Gord looked at Sand, motioned for him to come on, and ran for the place. Gord wasn't particularly surprised to see that the knife he had taken from concealment and now held ready was duplicated by the ones that Sand held. The boy had produced a wicked-looking stiletto, in fact even longer than Gord's weapon. Both were flushed with excitement, eager to join in the action. Break. All right. Now, this is quite a bit, but it's mostly a description of action. It does say, you know, a little bit more about both the tactics and society of Greyhawk, that the riverboat captain is there expecting this kind of attack, and even has gone down that alley to draw out whoever may be trying to waylay them. And yet, it's not said definitely, but quite from what Gord is saying, it sounds that even though they were expecting this, they weren't quite expecting the four thieves to come at them from behind. We see that Gord is knife-armed, and Gord and Sam are both prepared for a fight, and that the thief himself is prepared for a fight, but he's also there with a short sword instead of just a dagger, like most of the others had. To what effect the mercenaries, as swordsmen or armed with other regular combat weapons, are going to do against just the regular thieves, we have yet to see. There's a little description of the area around the Wheel of Gold, the alleyway. We know that the area around the gambling den is... It doesn't sound like the street is too crowded, but it is noisy. But there is still, around it, we're given the dark alley nearby.
Amidst, the secret corridors.
Yeah, the other establishment that, it's still a very, that the strip, even though it is lively, it is still has its, dark alleyways, and it has, so there is plenty around it that is more than just like a bustling street, that as soon as you get off that street, it is back to being a very dangerous city, even in the built-up areas. And here we have, again, that the Thieves Guild is going to commit crimes, robberies, violence, perhaps even murder, and yet it's an accepted part of the city of Greyhawk. Not just something that exists because they can't stop it, but it exists as an accepted part of the way that the city is run, the way it functions, and that speaks a lot toward what kind of campaigns you might find within Greyhawk, within the city of Greyhawk. It again is not, it is there kind of speaks to a bit of chaos in that, but still it's chaos and structure at the same time.
We don't know much officially about the government yet, right?
No, just there's only been the mention of the Lord Mayor and the directors, and that the Arentals, the Guildmaster, and the Thieves Guild director, he's one of the directors of the city, and that the Merchants Guild has a member who is one of the directors of the city. And that has, we don't know the size, what it does, what the laws are. In particular, we get back to Gord, who's caught stealing and is being thrown into that workhouse where his life, you know, you know, it could end at any moment. Very cavalier, he's sold, but he is not a licensed member of the Thieves Guild.
Right, that seems to be his major crime.
Well, it could be. I mean, we haven't heard what happens to thieves who are caught. Right. You know, are they just... there is this general mention that the thieves weren't worried about a beggar-thief war because if the lower thieves and the less skilled were killed, it would it would just be, you know, a bit Darwinism in action. It would be survival of the fittest.
They welcomed it.
Yeah, and the regular population of the city, from the common people to the director, the other... the head of the Merchants Guild, Arentol, head of the Thieves Guild, they weren't worried about taking casualties, in a sense, because they figured it would winnow down their ranks, and it would seem like there's probably always more potential Thieves Guild members out there. They probably have more people who want to be licensed thieves than they have openings, you know, areas for them to work. It is 7:02, so I'm going to end this for
already.
Today. Okay. Already, that hour passes by very quickly. We are still within Chapter 5, so it's not a big worry. We're here at the end of page 51, and it is not a big worry about missing. You know, it's just not possible to go chapter by chapter. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this, the earlier recordings, 1 to 5, are now archived. They are now available so that you can listen to them at your leisure or download them if you want to catch up. Pardon me, but if you want to just dive right in, we're examining the book area by area. I cover some context for what has happened, but not in the same detail. And so... you know, you can really feel that you don't have to listen to 5 hours worth of commentary and readings. You could listen if you want, but you can. I think anybody could jump right into recording 7, 8, 9, however it goes. I believe we're probably going to look at around 40 or 50 one-hour recordings with commentary to get through the whole book. Maybe even more. It depends on how much commentary. So I'm going to end it there for tonight. Thanks, and thanks for participating.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.